States Court of Appeals in and for the Seventh Judicial Circuit. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before this honorable court are admonished to draw near and give their attention as the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning, all. The first case for argument this morning is Mosley versus the Chicago Board of Education. Ms. Benna.
Good morning. May it please the court, I am Gabrielle Bina, an attorney with the law firm of Heller Ehrman in Madison, Wisconsin, which was appointed by this council as amicus to represent the interests of the plaintiff appellant in this matter, Lillian Mosley. By way of very brief background, Ms. Mosley filed two pro se complaints against the Chicago Public Schools and the Chicago Board of Education. The first complaint alleged that Ms. Mosley's son, who was a student of the Chicago Public Schools, was placed in special education classes without following the required procedures in violation of the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, or IDEA. That complaint was dismissed for failure to allege exhaustion of administrative remedies.
Could I ask you one clarification point, Ms. Bina?
Sure.
The Board of Education, in its brief, mentions at pages, the bottom of page 6, that it's, quote, agreeing with your argument that the IDEA should be interpreted to permit non-lawyer parents to represent the interests of their children in litigation. I understood your argument to be different, which was that there were both substantive and procedural rights that the parents themselves had, which they could assert in IDEA litigation, separate from any effort they might be making to represent their children without hiring a lawyer. And if you could just make clear what your position is, I think the implications of those two rules would be rather different.
We would love for the court to say that there is an exception to the usual rule that a pro se plaintiff can only represent him or herself. The extent that the court isn't prepared to do that, we would urge the court to follow the position taken in Maroney that parents, the First Circuit in Maroney, that parents have both substantive and procedural rights under the IDEA, which they can enforce under the IDEA. And because parents' interests and children's interests under the IDEA are aligned and that they're both seeking a free, appropriate public education for the child, the distinction may not be as meaningful in this context to create as great a distinction that would merit other consideration.
Okay, so just to be clear, I guess the principal point that you argue in the amicus brief, though, is that the parents themselves have some interest. We can see whether they're procedural and substantive, or whether they're, I suppose more courts have said they're just procedural. And if you look at the text of the statute, it's easy to find parents mentioned in a procedural sense. You know, you get notice and you sit in the meetings and you help formulate the IEP and you do all these other things. Is it going to make a big difference here whether we think Ms. Mosley has only procedural rights as a parent or has also a set of substantive rights?
Well, Ms. Mosley certainly had procedural rights violated in that she was not notified of any individualized education program. She was not given an opportunity to review her son's records until way down along the line. But in addition to that, her son was denied a free, appropriate education, and that harmed Ms. Mosley as well as her son, and that can harm parents generally if their child is not fully prepared for employment or independent living down the road because they haven't been given a proper education, or if they have to bear the burdens of paying for private education. In this case, Ms. Mosley homeschooled her son and eventually enrolled him in a GED program and had to bear the burdens of that.
Why isn't the denial of the free appropriate public education really his claim? And why wouldn't the remedy? Well, let me ask you this question. If we were to agree with you that it was precipitous to dismiss the IDEA case as opposed to the retaliation case at this preliminary stage on exhaustion grounds, is it too late to at least explore whether a lawyer would be available to represent the son?
No, I certainly don't think so.
I mean, I know there's a money issue, of course. There always is, but the statute does allow recovery of attorney's fees if somebody has a case that a lawyer thinks is worthy of taking.
Right, and presumably a parent could pursue their procedural and substantive rights under the IDEA along with the child pursuing procedural and substantive rights under the IDEA. But here, because the interests are aligned, we don't think it's necessary to have a separate attorney for the son and the mother.
And of course, the only reason I'm asking this is because if we were to decide that sort of the underlying substantive problem really belongs to the son, because Ms. Mosley was pro se, it's unclear to me, at least, whether she knew that she should be out there shopping around for a lawyer to represent her son, or whether she thought, in fact, she was entitled to do so. And actually, her amended complaint seems to assert a claim only on her own behalf, anyway. It's back here in the appendix. Yeah, on page A7, her amended complaint. Maybe I'm looking at the wrong thing, but the thing that's called amended complaint on page A7, paragraph 2, says, "I am hereby filing this amended complaint on behalf of myself, Lillian Mosley," and that's the only name you see at the top of the page. So I'm also wondering whether she's abandoned an effort to represent her son in this part of the case.
I don't think she is. Further along in that complaint, she does talk about her son having suffered mental anguish as a result of the actions taken by the school district. I think this needs to be read with the original complaint. Obviously, this is just a four-paragraph, if anything, kind of supplemental pleading. It doesn't address the exhaustion issues at all. It just adds an attempt to assert jurisdiction with various statutes.
But she didn't know there were exhaustion issues to address, did she?
I don't believe she did. If you look at the sequence of events, Ms. Mosley filed her IDEA complaint. The board then filed a Rule 12b1 motion to dismiss, alleging failure to exhaust as one potential ground for dismissal. The district court then issued an order directing Ms. Mosley to either respond to the motion or file an amended complaint without further directions. Ms. Mosley subsequently filed this four-paragraph document, which doesn't address the exhaustion issue, and a couple days later filed another document, which was essentially a response to the motion to dismiss, which stated that defendants filed a motion to have my case dismissed that I knew nothing of or received a copy of, but was informed by a letter from the district court judge. So from that sequence of events, and because the board hadn't filed an answer, because it had filed a motion to dismiss, I don't think we can assume that Ms. Mosley was on notice that exhaustion was at issue.
All right. What about the statute of limitations? That is the ground that the board argues in its brief is an independently adequate reason to affirm the judgment below.
The statute of limitations is an affirmative defense and need not be addressed in the complaint. No answer had been filed here, so no statute of limitations had been asserted in an answer. With respect to the IDEA complaint, I would submit that any statute of limitations issues may be alleviated if the court allows her to amend her complaint, because the time for the statute of limitations to run is told pending the pursuit of administrative remedies. With respect to the retaliation complaint, if we read the allegations as a whole, including the allegations that were raised during the status conference with the court and the hearing on the motion to dismiss, that coupled with allegations in the complaint, I think there's enough in there to stretch the allegations into September of 2001. And while we don't know what the meat of all of the allegations running that late are, I think at a minimum she should be given an opportunity to replead, especially given the liberal pleading standards afforded to Ms. Mosley in this type of action, and given that this is a motion to dismiss.
Is there any suggestion in the pleadings that the son is disabled?
That's an interesting question. It's not entirely clear whether this is a case where the school district unilaterally evaluated a student, determined that they were disabled, and placed them in a class, or whether they just placed them in a class for no reason at all.
Wouldn't we have to have an allegation, or at least a suggestion of an allegation of disability, to have an IDEA claim?
I would think so, but because Ms. Mosley's son was placed in a special education class without following the only procedures that there are to place a child in a special education class, I think that we have to apply the IDEA. And if we don't apply the IDEA, then the district court erred in dismissing it on grounds that they failed to exhaust the remedies available under the IDEA.
So basically, you're saying the allegation that he's put in a special ed class, which appears in the original unamended complaint, the one that starts at A1, plus, I suppose, maybe the allegation that this, in paragraph 13 of this progress report, showing that he's failing everything except Spanish and gym, that he never took Spanish, maybe on a liberal reading. I mean, certainly she mentions the special ed classes, but she also mentions academic difficulty.
The complaint alleges that he was that his teachers for kindergarten, second grade, and third grade were all special ed, and then in fourth grade is when she had a casual conversation with a teacher and found out that that teacher was special ed as well.
But then there's this allegation in paragraph 18 that he's put in a gifted sixth grade classroom. What's that all about?
Further on in the complaint, it discusses altercations with that teacher about whether he's permitted to stay in that gifted class or not, so I don't think her claims are eliminated by the fact that he was placed into a different type of class down the road, because there were continuing issues with respect to his education.
Okay.
And if the court has no further questions at this time, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Ms. Miller.
Thank you.
Ms. Gibbons.
Good morning, Your Honors. Kathleen Gibbons on behalf of the Board of Education of the City of Chicago. Your Honors, just because Ms. Mosley filed her complaints as pro se does not allow for repeated sloppy litigation and repeated chances and bites at that apple to continually go back and attempt to amend the complaint. Both Judge Conlon and Judge Kenley attempted to give her opportunities to amend or to clarify through hearings with Judge Kenley to try to get an actual idea of what is going on.
It makes any difference to me, but it's Kennelly.
Kennelly. Oh, I'm sorry. Kennelly, thank you.
Now, if you ever appear before him again, you will not ruffle his feathers.
Yes, thank you. Sorry. They attempted
to
help.
But, you know, Ms. Gibbons, the thing that troubles me about at least the course of proceedings below, and I realize your brief has backed off from that a bit, is that everyone needs to follow the rules, and the Board of Education was treating the topics of exhaustion and statute of limitations as though they were part of the plaintiff's claim, and they obviously are not. They're affirmative defenses that the plaintiff has no burden to prove. And on top of that, Judge Conlon committed the further sin of calling exhaustion a jurisdictional defense, whereas this court has repeatedly made it clear, and even in the IDEA context, we have a 1996 decision called Charlie F. versus Board of Education of Skokie, which addresses this issue specifically and says it's not jurisdictional. It goes to the question whether a claim is stated. It's waivable. You know, lack of jurisdiction isn't waivable. So My problem on several of these things, whether it's exhaustion, whether it's statute of limitations, is that these truncated procedures prevented any kind of factual development. This might have been a great candidate for summary judgment once we actually figured out, let's say, in the retaliation context, what was she complaining about, when did it happen, did it happen before or after that mid-July date that was the crucial mm-hmm. two-year date. Whatever the result is, but I'm not at all clear on this record what the facts are.
Well, Your Honor, you're correct. In Charlie F., you did rule that exhaustion could be waivable, and it wasn't the same as jurisdiction, but it also, in Charlie F., an IDEA complaint can be dismissed for failure to exhaust, and the board did raise that in its motion to dismiss, that if this is truly an IDEA claim, that the plaintiff must have exhausted her administrative remedies before she is entitled to come to court.
Absolutely, but the point is, how do we know? She didn't have to outline in her complaint the steps that she took to exhaust. If you raised it as an affirmative defense, then she could come back. We don't have any idea what she did, and I certainly the exhaustion process is a very important part of the IDEA process, because it hopefully gives people like the board, you know, the chance to nip these problems in the bud. But we don't know what happened here.
Your Honor, you're correct. The record as it stands that Judge Conlon had, we don't know. But we also, the Chicago Board of Education raised other issues. And in fact, you've questioned it here today. Was Melvin truly a child with a disability? Does the IDEA even apply?
And taking the facts in the light most favorable to the complaint, are we in a position right now to answer that obviously crucial question?
Well, no, but the court has multiple grounds upon which it could have denied it. So if this wasn't an IDEA claim, we would then have to assume she's attempting to do educational malpractice like the board raised in its motion to dismiss, which is not a recognizable cause of action.
So when she said that's true, when she says he's put in a special ed class, doesn't that suggest that there's a disability? You put people with no disabilities in special ed classes?
No, you're not supposed to. So that does suggest, and that's why the board went both ways and said if she's attempting to do an IDEA claim, we need exhaustion. But the key also is whether this is an IDEA claim or she's attempting to allege something else, the statute of limitations in that complaint for Melvin in front of Judge Conlon clearly expired on its face because the last alleged activity took place in April of 2001, and this suit was not filed until July of 2003. And even under the IDEA, there's a two-year statute of limitations.
Ms. Gibbons, was there some reason why, or perhaps it did occur, some reason why these cases weren't consolidated? I appreciate they were filed sequentially, but did the board move to have them as related?
No, Your Honor, and I can't explain why that was not done. But no, it was not done in the lower court. And we also...
Were there any appearances before Judge Connelly? Do you know?
Yes, another attorney for the Chicago Board of Education appeared.
Was Judge Connelly made aware that there was a... case pending before Judge Conlon?
Judge Connelly knew that there was a case pending before Judge Conlon, and there is specific references in the record, in the transcript on Volume 2, and he attempted to clarify with Ms. Mosley which allegations were covered by which complaint, and in that hearing, which occurred in October 20th, 2003, Judge Connelly specifically tried to figure out which complaints were for her in his suit and which were covered by Judge Conlon's suit. And during that hearing, Ms. Mosley clearly said all the allegations for Melvin were covered in the other suit. And if you do read both together, and then she had another point when she talks about harassment, then says the harassment was for myself and my son.
She contradicts herself. He's trying to clarify at A24, what are you talking about when you're talking about harassment? And this is in her
retaliation,
I think of it as the Connelly suit, the retaliation suit. And he says, is it because they weren't giving you the budget? And she says, not only did they do that, they harassed my son. And then he explores a little bit of that. When did the harassment occur? And she winds up saying, up until September the 18th, 2001. So by the time this colloquy is over, he's at least heard about September the 18th as a date.
Right, but
the status of that comment is maybe debatable, but it's there.
No, you're correct, but also in that transcript on page 10, I believe, I am cites to the record, he asks what is covered by Judge Conlon, and she says the allegations for my son, and if you look at the complaint in front of Judge Conlon, paragraphs 12 through 26 of her complaint deal with the disciplinary actions, which are also raised in the harassment suit.
Well, I mean, and I was surprised this wasn't consolidated either in the district court. It seemed to me a really inefficient way of proceeding just from the court's own administrative point of view. But I guess her theory, and whether this is a good theory or not, we can discuss, is that one way of harassing her is to harass her son. Maybe she's one of these parents that the school district or the board thinks is a pain in the neck, and she calls and bothers the principal all the time. So instead of dealing with her, they just, send her son off into Siberia and, don't let him have whatever things kids want at that age. And whether this kind of derivative harassment, if you will, works or not as a theory is one question, but it seems to me that's what she's trying to say. She's trying to say one of the ways of getting at me is to treat my son badly.
Correct, but she also told Judge Kennelly that that was covered by Judge Conlon. So what Judge Kennelly had in front of her, or him, understanding that, yes, there was alleged harassment. You look at the other complaint, she details the disciplinary action that was in front of Judge Conlon, that if he was a child with a disability, would also be covered under the IDEA and go down that way. You then have to go back to what retaliation occurred to her, and there was none. She was not removed as chairperson of the IASA. She was never, no allegations that she was arrested, never stopped passing out her flyers. There is no allegation that she was forbidden to speak at the board meeting. In fact, it's to the contrary. She lists several meetings with the Chicago Board of Ed. She was never denied a meeting with any Chicago Public School personnel. There's several allegations of constantly meeting. So I believe the term, the freeze-out, that the only thing that did not happen was she was not given a copy of the budget, clearly does not rise to a First Amendment complaint as it relates to her.
If you can get it down that narrow, certainly reading the amicus brief gives one a broader sense of what she's trying to say. I guess the only thing we can do is look at the transcript and come to our own conclusion. But
correct, and what was in front of the district court when they were making their decisions. And again, if you look at the retaliatory action against her, that ended on May 6th of 2000.
Well, she says, of course, it went right up to the time she stepped down from this position that she had, which again gets us over into September, right?
Right, but again, we have no allegations of that. And the simple
Why
fact that she stated...
Why does she have to plead facts?
Well, but all she pleads is she's the chairperson. As she details what actually occurred to her, all of what could somewhat be decided as retaliation occurred, even though I don't believe it rises to retaliation.
But she's alleged that she's harassed up until September, and you're, again, moving in a sense to step two, which is what facts, what events, and does she have a burden of alleging the particular events in a complaint?
No, it is liberal pleading, but I believe when you read it all together, the actual alleged harassment that may have occurred in September was for her son and not her, and again, she put that in Judge Conlon's court. But in front of Judge Conlon, that was not alleged. So we have two district court judges who are going on the face of the complaint that they have, and I believe both judges correctly dismissed the complaint.
The implication of what you're saying is if they had both had both complaints in front of them, some of them wouldn't have been dismissed, which is disturbing.
No, actually, I don't believe so. I think if it was consolidated, the dismissal would be more solid because we would have been able to do everything in chronology, and it would have become much clearer whether this truly was an IDEA complaint, and then the exhaustion kicks in if what is against Melvin is educational malpractice, that does not exist. And the retaliation against her ended before, clearly 2 years before she filed, and probably did not rise to retaliation. It was truly a freeze-out. And so based on that, we believe you should affirm both lower court decisions. Thank you. If there are no other questions.
Thank you, Ms. Gibbons.
Thanks.
Ms. Janet?
I'd just like to address a few points. First of all, I feel that the board's concerns about the retaliation claim really go to proof, and a failure of proof and a failure to state a claim are two different things, especially given the liberal pleading standards afforded to pro se plaintiffs. I submit that the retaliation complaint should not be dismissed to the extent that the dismissal turned on the fact that she inadequately pled adverse actions taken against her subsequent to those in the complaint. I think the fair course would have been to give Ms. Mosley the opportunity to amend to include such information rather than outright dismiss the case. One point on the IDEA complaint is that the court dismissed that complaint for failure to allege exhaustion, not for failure to exhaust. There was no finding that she failed to exhaust. And, in fact, documentation that Ms. Mosley has provided to us is relevant to that issue and I think would have been helpful for the district court to have before it. And because it's a factual issue, I think it would be important to remand to the district court to really get everything straightened out. I feel like Ms. Mosley should be given the benefit of the doubt here. This was her only recourse, as it is for many parents, and that's why it's so important for parents to be able to file pro se IDEA actions to protect their interest in their child education, to protect their child's right to a free, appropriate public education, which is the express purpose of the IDEA.
But you aren't saying that parents are the intended beneficiaries of the IDEA. Surely it's the children.
Well, parents can be harmed by violations of the IDEA. So in that sense, the enforcement of the IDEA benefits them, but they're not directly benefited as children are. With regard to the statute of limitations issues, again, statute of limitations is an affirmative defense. I don't think it's the case that the face of the complaints here admit definitively that the applicable limitations period had expired, and I think...
But what about the argument that Ms. Gibbons was suggesting that if we looked carefully at what she says to Judge Cannelli, she concedes that virtually everything that had to do with harassing her son belonged over in the Conlon case?
Well, there is kind of a cross-fertilization of allegations between the complaints. I think... Given her other statements to the contrary, and because we have to take the facts in the light most favorable to her, I don't think we can find that there weren't allegations up through September of 2001, which would bring it within the statute of limitations period.
Okay. So she's contradictory, basically, is what your best hope is that she contradicts herself in this discussion with Judge Cannelli. Sometimes she's saying, I'm being harassed because they're getting at me through my son, and sometimes she says, yeah, but the things about my son go over to the Conlon case.
I don't know that it was a direct contradiction. I think she was attempting to clarify in a difficult courtroom setting for a pro se plaintiff what the allegations of the other complaint were, and those allegations were regarding her son's special education, but that complaint did not contain the information about the freezing out of information about the school budget process, about her role as chairperson for purposes of the Improving America Schools Act, and some of the other allegations of retaliation in the complaint. So I think that each complaint on their own could be remanded, the dismissals vacated and remanded to the district court on their own, but taken together, that just enhances the case for that. If the court has no further questions, I will wrap up. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Our thanks to all counsel. And Ms. Bina and Mr. Skilton, special thanks to you for accepting this amicus appointment and to your firm. The court does appreciate that. The case is taken under advisement.